Rodney maintained his innocence the entire time. And I would often say, well, if you lie enough, you will believe it.
In 2010, DNA testing reveals there's no physical evidence tying Rodney Lincoln to Joanne Tate's murder. All that's left now is Melissa's adamant, unwavering eyewitness testimony.
It was heinous. It was sadistic. I know he did it.
I'm Leah Rothman. This is The Real Killer, Episode 6, I Need to Go Back. For the last 12 years, Kay Lincoln and her dad's attorneys at the Midwest Innocence Project have been on a roller coaster ride fighting for Rodney's release. During that time, there have been intense highs and crushing lows in Melissa's life as well.
When my daughter was little, you know, I had resolved that I'd be a great mom to her, and supportive, and I'd have a bond with her. The truth is, I had a hard time completely connecting to her. Mine was a fear of loving someone so much that they would be taken away from me. Because of my job with the Department of Defense, and at the time, mental health help was not, you couldn't get it without risk losing your clearance. My daughter paid for that. When she was 11, she convinced me that the best programs for science and mathematics and robotics were where her dad was. He lived in Oregon, and I didn't want to let her go, but I knew she had a chance. And the hardest thing I did is I let her go. But she had a dream and I didn't want to squash it. I didn't want her to be exposed to my dysfunction. So I let her down. I let her down.
Also around this time, Melissa has to say goodbye to someone else she holds precious, her baby sister.
Renee had cervical cancer and she died within a year or so of being diagnosed. She had three kids. She had two girls and a boy. Renee was very tired by the time she reached 31. She was tired of being alive. And I think she fought as hard as she could. Renee was part of my foundation. She was gone. I wanted to run and never stop. But everywhere I went, it was the same because the things I was running from was inside of my being.
In the years that follow, Melissa does her best to move past the pain and trauma. She gets a degree in criminal justice and finds another great job, this time as a supervisor at a medical imaging center. Just when life is starting to normalize a bit, she gets a message from a friend that levels her.
He said, Melissa, you're in the news again. They're talking about you and your mom again, and it was something for Rodney. And I just realized at that moment, I couldn't pretend to be normal anymore. The next day, I went into work, I put my badge on my desk, and I quit my job.
In 2014, Melissa is diagnosed with complex PTSD and is unable to work.
I was waiting to be approved for disability, so I had no money and no job. I slept in basements. I slept on couches. I was homeless, and I had nothing of my own.
Melissa's cousin, who lives in the quaint town of Coraopolis, Pennsylvania, right outside Pittsburgh, invites her to move in. So she does. There's stability once again, but it won't last for long. 2015 is going to be a year like no other. Here's Kay Lincoln.
During the summer of 2015, I got an email from Bill Clutter, who was a private investigator who had been aware of my dad's case. And he contacted me and said that he was working with a production crew for a television program called Crime Watch Daily, and they were looking for cases that someone had been wrongfully convicted, and it was a possibility that Tommy Lincells may have been the perpetrator.
Much more on Tommy Lynn Sells later, but first, some background on Crime Watch Daily. In 2015, I am working as a writer there. It's an hour-long program, 5 days a week, dedicated to true crime, mostly murder. And with that dark kind of subject matter day in and day out, I was thankful for the camaraderie we had, especially in the writer's room. Anyway, I talked a little bit about how Crime Watch Daily ended up telling this story in episode one, but here are a few more details. Basically, I was asked to see if we had enough to tell the intended story. It was supposed to be like a 10-minute profile piece on the true crime author Diane Fanning and her book, Through the Window, which is about the serial killer, Tommy Lynn Sells. So after reviewing all the interviews and research, I told my bosses that we needed to shift the focus and take a closer look at Rodney's case. And we needed to interview Rodney and Melissa. They agreed. Rodney is quickly on board, but Melissa, well, she takes a minute.
I was adamant that I wouldn't do it, and then suddenly there I was, ready to tell my story, and ready to talk about Mom, and ready to look in that camera and say without a shadow of a doubt that Rodney did it.
A few months later, on November 23rd, 2015, the episode entitled Who Killed Joanne Tate airs. And Rodney maintains his innocence.
God knows I'm no angel. Yes, I killed a man. Never in my life could I or would I harm a child. No way.
Melissa is equally steadfast in his guilt.
There is no way it could be anybody but Rodney. I know. He knows. God knows.
Also on the show are private investigator Bill Clutter and Diane Fanning. Both had done extensive research on Tommy Lynn Sells, and both agreed that there are a lot of similarities between his crimes and Joanne Tate's murder. In a series of interviews, calls, and correspondence, Tommy Lynn Sells told Diane Fanning, among many other things, there are crimes other people are sitting in prison for that he actually committed. But he won't discuss anything that he did in St. Louis because he still has family there. Here's Melissa.
I will never forget that week. My cousin was supposed to watch a show with me the night it aired, and she didn't. So I tried to wait. And curiosity was getting the best of me, so I started to watch it at the house, and I couldn't. I remember seeing a crime scene picture pop up, and I just immediately, like, paused it because I had never seen that picture since I lived it.
Had you ever seen the crime scene photos?
No. I actually... I don't remember what year it was, but it was evidentiary hearing. And after many years of asking to see pictures, I got shown 3 or 4. They were not super graphic. The ones that showed up in Crime Watch Daily were new. And immediately, it could have just been the pictures alone or the background music that came with it. But I felt scared. I felt like there was someone around the corner of the living room, that I was in danger, that I needed to hide.
This hits hard, because as a true crime producer, I've often worried about how telling these stories affects survivors and victims' family members. Even during the making of this podcast, I've asked myself if I'm re-traumatizing Melissa. She's assured me all along the way she's okay. In fact, it's actually helping her heal. I sure hope that's true. Anyway, for Kay, it's what happens after the show that's most significant.
The program was shown on a Monday night. On Thanksgiving morning, that Thursday, I woke up and had a Facebook message from Nathaniel Clenny. And his Facebook message said that my sister and I believe that your dad is innocent. And we want to know how we can help him, but we're afraid of hurting Melissa. We want to protect Melissa. would you please call me? And he gave me his phone number. And when I spoke with him that day, he told me there had been doubts throughout the years, but they were always kind of pushed back because Melissa was so adamant. He also told me a really heartwarming story about during the trial. One day, they couldn't find his mom. She kind of disappeared, and they went looking for her. And they found her sitting in the cafeteria, eating lunch with my grandmother. And they were like, "Mom, why are you talking to her?" And she told them, "This woman hasn't done anything to any of us. She's lost a child, too." The two mothers, the mother of the murder victim and the mother of the man accused of killing her, were sitting there having lunch together.
I see you're getting a little emotional talking about that.
It makes me sad for both of them. But also, you know, it's just kind of heart... It's just an emotional thing that they were able to come together just both as grieving mothers and just be human, be kind to each other. It's a rare quality in this world.
When Melissa finally watches the show, she tells her cousin,
"I said something's not right. Something's not right. What I remember is not right." And I started to cry. I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "The family didn't want to tell you, but we've had our doubts for a very long time." And I felt something within me just break open a little bit. I was afraid because I knew I had to go back and look at what I remembered. I created a safe place. And there's little Melissa there. And I tell her, "I need permission to go look at what I put away a long time ago. And I'm going back. And I'm in that day at the park. And I'm with my mom. And I'm in that night. And I'm seeing the same things that I knew I had seen. That wasn't different. It was the man that was different. Rodney was not there. Rodney was never in our house that night. Never, never. He did not kill my mom. He didn't hurt me or my sister. He wasn't there. He didn't sit and watch TV while we died. He didn't violate my body. He didn't violate my mother, brutalize her after she was gone. He didn't cause that blood to be everywhere. He didn't cause me to scream. He didn't cause me to be afraid of men. Rodney was never there. And I came out of that moment, I felt like I couldn't breathe. And I felt so scared. I felt so little. I felt so bad. I felt so, so bad. When I went back and I allowed myself not to see Rodney, I absolutely saw wild, squirrely facial hair. I smelled beer. His hair was frizzy, like almost kind of curly. And he was a bigger guy. And it's strange, though, how, like, the thing that sticks out to me the most was the dead eyes. Like, he looked cold and detached, and yet he was enjoying it.
Now it's someone else's mugshots plastered all over the show that stirs up Melissa's buried memories.
I know Tommy Linsells killed my mom. I know he was in that house. I know he's that one that hurt us and stabbed us. I see that face. I know that face. I know that face is Bill.
Tommy Linsells' mugshots and what Melissa hears Diane Fanning say about him make her now believe he is Bill.
She was saying that he talked about not acknowledging really the people that he hurt in St. Louis because he had family there. But what got me was the MO. The MO for his crimes. It was very similar to things that had happened to us.
What do you do with this new realization?
I couldn't sleep on it. I knew right away I had to do the right thing.
It's now late November 2015, and Kay Lincoln gets a friend request she never saw coming.
That Saturday after Thanksgiving, I was sitting in my living room. I was on the phone with my sister and a close family friend, and I had my laptop open to Facebook, and I said, you guys, I just got a friend request from Melissa. And once I accepted the request, I saw that I also had a message from her. The message said, can we talk? And in my mind, I thought, do we want to talk? Do we want to argue? Do we want to fight? Whatever it is, I'm up for it. So I said, yes, absolutely. And I sent her my phone number. And she said, she responded saying, I'm so scared. I feel like I'm losing my mind. And when I read that, my hair stood on end. I got chills. I'm getting chills right now just thinking about it, just remembering that moment. And I knew. I responded to her, don't be scared. It's going to be okay. I'm calling you right now, because she had sent me her phone number. And I dialed her number, and she picked it up, and she was just sobbing on the other end. She was crying, and all she kept saying was, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Your poor dad. I'm so sorry. And I just kept trying to reassure her and calm her down that it's not her fault. None of it is her fault. She was just a baby. She was 7 years old. She said that there were times through the years when she felt doubt. And she wasn't sure that she had picked the right person. And every time she did doubt that, she would contact the prosecutors or the victim's advocate, and they would reassure her that, no, this was him. It was Rodney Lincoln. She had the right person. And so she would just push those doubts back down.
Then Rodney hears the unbelievable news.
I just knew it this time. Now they got nothing. No hair, no witness. And she's going to tell the courts I was wrong. Let him go.
So Rodney's MIP lawyers request a meeting with the circuit attorney's office just to get the wheels of justice moving. In the meantime, Melissa is interviewed by Crime Watch Daily for a follow-up show. Basically, a show about her shocking recantation. That weekend, Melissa also sits down to write an affidavit officially recanting, which she'll bring to the meeting at the circuit attorney's office. In it, she states that Rodney Lincoln is not her mother's killer. She now believes Tommy Lynn Sells is. With her, while writing the affidavit, is the PI, Bill Clutter, who had investigated Tommy Lynn Sells for years. By the way, I'm not sure who suggested the affidavit or why Bill Clutter was there when it was written. Melissa doesn't remember either. A few days later, on December 4th, 2015, the meeting with the circuit attorney's office takes place. There that day are investigator Quinn O'Brien, Rodney's daughter Kay, and Rodney's attorney Tricia Rojo Bushnell, who was hired as MIP's legal director in 2013. Before that, Tricia worked with the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama and at the Wisconsin Innocence Project and the Criminal Appeals Project at the University of Wisconsin School of Law. So, Tricia, Quinn, and Kay are at the meeting, but not allowed in. Those who are, Melissa, Uncle Nat and Aunt Lori, someone from the Victim Services Unit, a captain with the St. Louis Metro PD, and the assistant circuit attorney all sit around a large conference room table.
Now, I know there's a lot of people in here, and I just want to make sure. Are you comfortable with the presence of everyone here? We want you to be comfortable.
Yes.
We want you to feel at ease.
Yes, I am completely comfortable with everyone that is here.
That's Ed Bistocco. He was the assistant circuit attorney. Now, he's the chief warrant officer, which means he's the head liaison for the police when they bring criminal charges to prosecutors for consideration. Remember, he was basically the one for the last several years who handled Rodney's case for the circuit attorney's office. He'll be leading the meeting, which is videotaped. After the introductions, Ed addresses Melissa, who's sitting at the head of the table.
You and I have been had some sort of communication. You know, we've met in
for
person
years.
A number of times, and
yeah.
And we have talked on the phone many times. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
And I don't know the exact time we started communicating, but it was probably around 2002 or 2003.
I would say 2002.
During that entire time period, you were consistent that Rodney Lincoln was the perpetrator of the offense.
Yes.
Okay.
100%, and even never, no doubt.
Okay. Good. So that gets us into now. We talked in September. You know, you were still very firm then, very adamant that Rodney Lincoln was the perpetrator of this offense.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about what has developed since September.
Melissa tells them about watching the show and then learning her family has been quietly living with their doubts for years.
That gave me permission to really think about it.
When you say it gave you permission, what do you mean by that?
For years, I felt like anything that I did that would ever contrast with who I said was in prison, which was Rodney, I felt like anything I said against that would be betraying my family, would be betraying the detectives that worked so hard on the case, and it would be betraying you guys, because you guys have stood behind me the whole time. And it sounds so dumb, but that's what I felt. When this all happened, I told the police that the man had worked on my mom's car, that he said his name was Bill, that he was from Hollywood, that he had a Volkswagen. I told them all of that. So I don't know how Rodney got there. And that makes me very angry, because I felt as my 7-year-old self, my responsibility was to talk because my mommy couldn't. You know, and I felt like I had to tell what happened. And the man who stabbed me, he sat on top of me and used this hand to stab me. And I told the cops that. Rodney Lincoln is left-handed. I just feel like they had so many opportunities to fix this, and they did the worst police work. And it makes me sad, because I did my job. I did.
Then Ed asks about the affidavit Melissa wrote before this meeting.
The words in the affidavit, your words, somebody else's words, or did
my
you
words.
Just fill in? Okay, all your words?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because so there was some level of detail that I was a little surprised to see.
Yeah, I mean, we sat down next to each other, and we went over it. I told him things to put in there. There's certain phrases and stuff I told him to put in there.
Okay.
Certain words like manipulated, yes, that exactly came from me.
Okay.
but, you know, he had some details. These were details I already knew. Yes, those are my words, though.
You used the word earlier, manipulated. Mm-hmm. Who do you feel manipulated you?
Joe Burgone.
Joe did?
I don't think he did it on purpose. I think it was terrible police work. And I love him. He was like a dad to me.
All right.
I really don't want to believe he did it on purpose.
Okay.
But I feel like I was so vulnerable back then, and the city was out for blood. They wanted to catch who did it.
So I guess I'm not quite clear. So are you saying that Rodney Lincoln did not commit this act,
mm-hmm.
and you're not sure who did, or that Tommy Sells did, or Tommy Sells might have, or what is your feeling on that?
Oh, Rodney Lincoln did not commit this act. It was Tommy Sells.
Okay.
He absolutely entered our home and tried to kill Renee and I. He murdered my mom.
Okay. The reason you say you know who did it is based upon what? That's what I want to...
The flashbacks and the recollections.
Okay.
Assistant Circuit Attorney Mary Pat Carl goes back to the affidavit. It's about to become a very big problem.
I know you said to Ed that these are your words.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to sound silly. They can't all be your words, though, right? I mean, I've been a lawyer for 13 years,
mm-hmm.
and if I were going to write something,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't write in legalese unless I was, like, specifically writing a court document. So most people, and, you know, I mean, I've worked in domestic violence and in sex crimes. I'm very, very familiar with
mm-hmm.
kind of the merger of what happens when a layperson who does not write in legalese and somebody who is an investigator and does,
mm-hmm.
it ends up sort of a shared grouping of words.
Well, those are my words.
Right, but yeah. That means that he probably typed that because in his mind he was writing you, Melissa, knew as...
Okay, now I feel like we're splitting hairs and I'm getting irritated.
I don't mean to do that, but I just mean, I want to know...
We wrote this is going to be the subject. Those are my words.
Okay, and I'm just asking, sooner or later this is going to end up, this next chapter mm-hmm. is going to end up with me. And it's going to be my job and some other people's jobs to analyze and decide where do we go from here.
The right thing is where you guys go.
Okay, and it'll be my job to figure that out, to figure out what the right thing to do is.
I have been a puppet of this city for years. I'm done. And I told you those are my words.
And that's fine. If that's the answer, that's fine. But if it came to my attention, it's going to come to someone else's attention, and I want to be able to answer for it.
And let them come after me.
No one's coming after you. No one at all.
I'm so tired of this.
No one's coming at you at all. I didn't.
What, you think I'm not smart enough to use those words?
No. Melissa, nobody is saying that. Melissa,
not at all.
Nobody is saying that.
We can move on from the subject, Melissa. It is simply.
So if I would have typed it up on my computer, then would you be happy? Would you? I will do that for you.
Melissa, nobody's criticizing you.
I need a minute.
I just want to be sure. Okay.
I'm not going to allow the state to keep him here, and I hope you guys did the fucking right thing.
Melissa has just stormed out of the meeting at the circuit attorney's office. She returns not long after. Things are calmer, for sure. But it's clear. Freeing Rodney is going to be an uphill battle. Former circuit attorney Jennifer Joyce wasn't in the meeting that day, but here's, in part, what she had to say in her statement about Melissa's recantation. Quote, "My reaction to Melissa's recantation was one of sadness and heartbreak for Melissa. She has been through so much over the years, and the efforts by some to advocate for Rodney Lincoln's innocence were relentless. After hearing the evidence involved in this case, a jury and multiple appellate courts have so concluded. I have not seen anything to make me believe that they are wrong." I also asked Jennifer Joyce what evidence there is that Rodney did it. She referred me to the various court records and Melissa's, quote, "adamant witness identification." But despite Jennifer Joyce's apparent belief in Rodney's guilt, she said this: "Since Mr. Lincoln had already spent a significant amount of time in jail, I wanted to do whatever I could to bring some peace to Melissa. However, I lacked the legal power to take any action." Here's Rodney's attorney, Tricia Bushnell.
So, you know, after the recantation meeting, I went to meet with Ed Pistacco, and we sort of were like, can we come to an agreement? Right? You don't have a case anymore. She's now recanted it, and you couldn't convict him. You couldn't arrest him, right? You wouldn't have no evidence. So can we come to an agreement?
Tricia's basically told no. The problem is it's out of the circuit attorney's office's hands because they are no longer the responding party. Here's why. The responding party is not the county where Rodney was convicted, St. Louis County. It's where he's currently being held, which is Jefferson City Correctional in Cole County. So, now it's in the Attorney General's hands because they represent the Department of Corrections and handle all post-conviction appeals and habeas corpus appeals. So, Rodney's lawyers file a habeas corpus petition, which basically says someone, Rodney in this case, is being unconstitutionally held, and that gets filed against the warden of the prison. That petition will culminate in an evidentiary hearing in the coming months. You met Sean O'Brien in the last episode. Here he is describing the four claims detailed in the petition.
We raised four arguments against Rodney's conviction. The first one was just simply that he was innocent, that under the Amrine standard, he should be released because the evidence that he's innocent is clear and convincing. Joe Amrine, who was tried and convicted and sentenced to death, I actually argued his case in the Missouri Supreme Court, and the Missouri Attorney General told the court that it didn't matter if Joe was innocent, he should still be executed anyway. And fortunately, the Missouri Supreme Court, when they saw that extreme position, they rejected it, and Joe is free. Rodney Lincoln's case is a perfect example of that. The second claim challenged the hair. You know, hair evidence is junk science. The third claim was Brady versus Maryland. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says the due process clause of the 14th Amendment is violated when the prosecutor withholds evidence that would be helpful to the defense, especially if it might make a difference to the jury. So that was based on the DFS reports, Mary Flotron's reports, that Melissa was identifying other men, including the prosecutor, as the assailant in this case. The fourth claim was ineffective assistance of counsel, and that was based on all the questionable things about Robert Hamby's poor defense of Rodney, but also his interest arising from his involvement in this fraud scheme that evolved into a murder case literally the morning of Rodney's trial. Oh my God.
Insane.
You can't make this up. You just can't make this up.
While MIP lawyers are preparing their case, the Attorney General's office wastes no time on theirs. Mid-January 2016, Assistant Attorney General Mike Spillane interviews Detective Joseph Burgoon and victims advocate Mary Flotron. And in these interviews, there's a lot of talk about some new, well, not so new evidence they think they have against Rodney. It's what will come to be known as the Funny Finger story. Basically, it's been alleged that Melissa, back around the time of the trials in 1983, told her victim's advocate Mary Flotron that the bad man had a funny finger. Rodney Lincoln is missing part of his right pinky. So for the Attorney General, this is just more proof that Rodney is the killer.
In all of her statements to everyone prior to the trial, she never said anything about the killer missing a finger.
MIP believes this story was fabricated. If Melissa had told Mary Flotron the bad man had a funny finger, it would have been in those DFS reports they discovered, and the prosecution would have used it at trial.
The missing finger story came when we started alleging that Rodney didn't do it. It appeared to sabotage Melissa's recantation by inventing this funny finger story.
In January 2016, Assistant Attorney General Mike Spillane also talks with the prosecutor for both trials, Joe Bauer. I was able to get my hands on that audio taped call.
Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Bauer. This is Mike Spillane. How are you, sir?
I'm okay. How are you, Mike?
Pretty good.
They discuss many things, like the funny finger story, the DFS files, and Melissa's stellar performance on the stand. Here's Joe Bauer.
Well, I gotta tell you, you'd have had to been there. That 7-year-old girl is the best witness I've ever seen. She just was believable, pretty even keel for someone who'd been through everything she'd been through. He could cross-examine her all he wanted, and he was never going to make a dent in what she said. And I don't know why she's recanting now, because I've talked to her 5 or 6 times in the last 30 years, and, you know, she was always upset. She'd call me when the parole board was going to meet to see if they were going to let him out. And, I don't know what happened here other than I think his family's investigators wore her down. Or maybe she likes the attention now. I don't know. But, he could have cross-examined her for a month and not gotten anywhere.
Yeah, her memory isn't better now than it was 30 years ago.
I reached out to both Assistant Attorney General Mike Spillane and Joe Bauer for comment, but never heard back. On March 17th, 2016, scores of people descend on the courthouse in Cole County for the evidentiary hearing on the habeas corpus petition. I mean, it's packed. A handcuffed 71-year-old Rodney Lincoln is brought in. When he sees the courtroom full of his supporters, he smiles and mouths the word, wow, several times. And Melissa's there, too. She'll be testifying. Here's Sean O'Brien explaining the state's position.
The attorney general's response was, first of all, procedural. This case is so old. He's had all these chances to fight his conviction. It's over. It doesn't matter if he can prove he's innocent. He does not have a claim. And then they turned and fought Melissa on her recantation. And they tried to attribute the recantation to manipulation by the media. They tried to undermine her credibility, and they attacked her viciously.
They wanted to bring up the fact that I was paid for my pictures.
Who paid?
Crime Watch gave me money for my pictures. I said, my murdered dead mother, my little tiny violated sister, my mutilated body, and my traumatized family. Do you really think that my nice hotel room and $300 for my pictures and TV producers were what changed my mind and made me sell out my mother and my family and recant?
The other tactic was that they acted as if our case depended entirely on the guilt of Tommy Lynn Sells.
When she recanted, we were shocked, to say the least, when she was also saying that it was Tommy Lynn Sells. Did that dilute the recantation?
Yeah.
Did that
yeah.
complicate the case for you?
Tremendously. It made our job much harder. It handed the attorney general an argument that they should not have had.
A few months later, on June 16th, 2016, Judge Daniel Green hands down his 19-page decision. The second-to-last line reads, quote, simply put, the court does not find the recantation credible. Rodney will remain in prison.
I was a credible witness when I was a traumatized child with multiple stab wounds who had just observed a heinous invasion and violation of her body and her family. I was medicated and scared of men, and yet I was more credible then than as a grown adult woman who had a background not only in the Navy, but as a Department of Defense contractor in the intelligence community, as a woman with a degree in criminal justice, as a person who lived very honestly and tried to do the right thing. I was less credible.
Did you feel, I mean...
It made me more resolute.
Yeah.
I let them know in many ways, I'm not going away. You're not going to shut me up. Everything I love, I've lost. I've met death and I've been abused. I'm not afraid of anything anymore. Bring it.
Next time on The Real Killer.
I never exactly knew which cells I would see when I went into that visitation room.
When serial killer Tommy Lynn Sells is nearby, no one's safe.
And one time, Leah, I swear, the shape of his face changed. The color of his eyes changed. And I realized at that moment that I was seeing what his victims saw at the last moment before they died.
Is he Joanne's killer, or is it someone closer to home?
He said that he was in a house with a woman and two little girls. And he said it was a bloody mess.
The Real Killer is a production of AYR Media and iHeartRadio, hosted by me, Leah Rothman. Executive producers Leah Rothman and Aliza Rosen for AYR Media. Written by me, Leah Rothman. Senior Associate Producer Eric Newman. Editing and sound design by Cameron Taggy. Mixed and mastered by Cameron Taggy. Audio engineering by Jesus C. Murillo. Studio engineering by Tom Weir and Kelly McGrew. Legal counsel for AYR Media, Gianni Douglas. Executive producer for iHeartRadio, Chandler Mays. If you're enjoying The Real Killer, tell your friends about it and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.